This podcast, like hentai, contains mature themes that may not be appropriate for all children.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
And welcome to Science Faction 227, a Science Faction neuroparasitology.
So, the study of brain parasites?
Absolutely, it's actually. Like that's really surprising that you got that so easily.
It's like a Can-Ham type.
Yeah, that would be a brain parasite that would get in you.
I think the first clue is neuro, and then the second clue is parasitic.
But how did I know that? I'm illiterate, Allison.
Yeah, that's right.
It's true. But you did beat me in the BS.
I've never heard that. I don't remember that happening.
Thank you. Thank you for coming out on the record, Allison.
It's like when you let the Down syndrome kid score a touchdown in the NFL game.
Oh, man. I can't wait till the Mueller investigation finishes and Bobby goes down.
All right. So this is, of course, the study of animal brain parasites. So we've talked about some of these before. Toxoplasmosis, because toxoplasmosis is one that actually affects humans as well as animals. Toxo is a brain parasite that likes to breed inside the stomach of cats. So what it does is it breeds inside the stomach of cats, gets pooped out by the cats, gets into a mouse or a rodent of some kind, because the rodents go and eat the cat poo, gets into there. Once it gets in there, it goes, hey, I want to be back in that cat's stomach. So it gets into their brain and rewires their brain. So not only are they not scared of cats anymore, they become sexually aroused by the smell of cat urine. So then they smell cats and they run out and they're like, ah, bring it on, lady, let's do it. And they get eaten, and then the parasite gets back into the cat's stomach where it wants to breed.
Now, toxoplasmosis, that one is toxo, which is toxic, and plasmosis, which is maize.
No, goddammit. He already got it in early. He got the maize in early. Oh, I meant to block it.
Get your defenses up.
Dang it.
So now, but how does it travel from that cycle of cat tummy to rat brain into people?
Good question. Most often, it's due to contact with the cat litter box.
So ownership.
That's why pregnant women are told to never change cat litter boxes, because they get toxo. Now, a lot of humans have toxoplasmosis. In places like parts of Brazil, the infection rate can be like close to 50%. In some other place, if you're a cat owner, a lot of times you will have toxoplasmosis or a toxoplasmosis infection. For the most part, that just means some cold-like symptoms. As far as we know, you might not even notice you have it unless you're pregnant, in which case it can essentially abort the fetus or cause very serious birth defects. So that's why pregnant women are not supposed to be near it, near cat poo. However, there is some very intriguing evidence that suggests it might affect the human brain similar to the way it affects the rat brain, in that it might disinhibit our fear a little bit. In fact, a shocking percentage, way higher than we would think statistically, of motorcycle accidents are people with a recent toxo infection. So think about it.
Is that why I'm turned on by cat urine?
Yeah, you think of cat urine and that big bad boy riding that Harley.
Yeah. Mm. Is that why most Hell's Angels have a cat? Get over here, Mr. Fluffykins. Yeah. I'm going to cuddle you so good.
Well, think about it. You're a regular motorcycle rider. You get a toxoplasmosis infection. All of a sudden, the inhibitions that are normally there, even if you decrease it by 15 or 20%, you're going to increase your fatality rate on something as dangerous as a motorcycle. That might be causing a lot of problems. There's a lot of what appears to be some inhibitions taken away, including some criminal activities and some DUI-type activities that seem to correlate in human beings with toxo. We don't know this for sure. It's a very interesting field of research, whether or not our brains are being affected by this. But more and more research comes out that suggests, even in some small way, it is. Now, not all of these parasites affect humans as well. In fact, most of them stick with just animals. Some of them are just insects. They're usually very species-specific, because neurology is a very species-specific type of thing. So usually a parasite that affects one type of brain won't affect every type of brain, or at least won't do the same job. But it would be interesting to see where this goes, because we might find a future where we find out that we have a bunch of these infections ourselves that we haven't noticed yet that cause different neuro effects.
Well, I hear that Trump paid a Russian parasite to get these parasites to help him win the election.
No. His lawyer paid them. He just reimbursed them later on.
Okay.
It could be that we have these infections that are inside us that we don't even know that affect our health, our mental health. In fact, there have been some people who have postulated certain cases of schizophrenia or other mental disorders we might be lumping in and say, oh, this is all just some kind of genetic predisposition for schizophrenia, while they actually might be the result of some kind of parasitic brain infection that we haven't recognized yet, because they're very hard to notice, especially if you're not looking for them. And a lot of times they'll just, you know, somebody gets sick for 2 weeks, you don't think that they necessarily have a lifelong parasitic brain infection.
I do want to see correlative studies on how people vote.
Yeah.
And they're if they've
recent
toxo
implant. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm voting for the super fast motorcycle.
We've discussed on this show that hookworm makes you dumb.
Yes. Was responsible for a significant amount of the lowered IQ throughout the South for over 100 years.
Yeah, hookworm lives in the South. I think you could do a political study along those lines.
Hookworm is a good example.
We have kaleworm here in California.
That is very interesting. It also might be, and this is something to think about, we are now in the era of CRISPR. It could be that we find some of these parasitic infections that affect other animals or insects, and we genetically modify it to infect humans on purpose. So if you wanted to cause a problem, if you wanted to cause a zombie outbreak, maybe all you need to do is modify some of these brain-controlling things that exist in nature already to go to us or to better affect us, more effectively get us, and then release it on the population.
And CRISPR?
Oh, sorry. CRISPR is, of course...
It's a rice CRISPR.
Very good treats.
CRISPR, of course, genetic editing software that we essentially stole from bacteria and has allowed us to have this new revolution in genetics where we can essentially just modify anybody's genome at will. You can actually order CRISPR kits at home, modify your own genome, which at least one rogue researcher has done. CRISPR is now becoming so ubiquitous that you can order it off the internet.
Is there an app now?
Just CRISPR app? Yeah, where you're like, oh, I want to get blue eyes now. Yeah.
Blue eyes? You're not saying superpowers? That wasn't your first?
Ability to charm any woman is a superpower to me. Anyway, a very interesting field of study. We'll see where it ends up. This might be one of those things that end up being really horrible for us, or we recognize a problem that's existed for a long time and are able to fix it, and turns out to be really good. Regardless, neuroparasitology is a very interesting science, interesting field to go into. And speaking of an interesting field, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. With me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damian Mercado. Damian, how you doing this afternoon?
It's doing great. And this is the first interesting field that you've ever been into because you entered the field of archaeology day to day.
God damn it. And of course, our scientist for the evening, Dr. Allison Gill. Dr. Gill, how you doing?
I'm good. Thank you. How are you?
I am doing fantastic because we have Allison back in the studio. And if you guys want to do fantastic, go ahead and check out our website, www.thesciencefaction.com, for all the articles we cover here, as well as some we don't get to. And if you are hearing this on its release date in a few days, if you happen to be in the San Diego area, I will be doing a show for the Reuben H. Fleet for the opening of Solo, a Star Wars story. I will be doing a complete Star Wars comedy stand-up set at the Sandbox at the downtown, and we have a costume contest associated with it. Right after that, we are going to head out and see Solo, a Star Wars story, before it is released. So, if you are a Star Wars nerd and you want to see not only some Star Wars stand-up and a Star Wars costume contest, but go see it before any of the other nerds get a chance to do it, go ahead and check out the Reuben H. Fleet website where you can get tickets there. And then on June 5th, I will be doing Nerd Night in San Diego, where I'll be doing a stand-up presentation for a museum exhibit I'm developing called The Science of Funny. You can get tickets for that at Nerd Night or Eventbrite. Go ahead and check out either of those two shows. They're both pretty novel and interesting. So if you're interested in either Star Wars stand-up or nerdy stand-up about why things are funny, go ahead and check those out. Allison, I think you have a big show coming up for Mueller, She Wrote, don't you?
Yeah, we do. We're doing our first live Q&A panel and comedy show at the world-famous Comedy Store.
Ooh.
Here in La Jolla. They reached out to us, said they wanted to host a live panel, and we said, I'm going to have to think about that. I don't know. Comedy Store, never heard of it.
Yeah.
No, of course, we jumped on it immediately. We love teaming up with them. And
that's such a great room, too.
Yeah, so we're going to do a little bit of our comedy sets, just some short ones, but then we're going to do the main part, which is a live Q&A panel. All your Mueller questions answered.
Very, very interesting. And, of course, check out Mueller, She Wrote, which is your podcast that is just meteoric rise. It is fantastic. It's the best, if not the only, I don't know, maybe somebody else is trying to copy you. Certainly the best podcast that looks at the Mueller investigation that I've seen out there.
We were the first. I think there's another one that came out just a couple of months ago called Mueller Time.
Uh-huh.
They've acknowledged us as
the grandfather
the
of
superior,
it.
Superior. Yeah. No.
They acknowledge you as the Coke to their Pepsi or to their RC Cola.
Yeah, it was more of an RC Cola.
But no, they're great dudes. Yeah, so yeah, that's us.
Super interesting podcast. If you are not a person who is normally super drawn into politics, it will draw you in. So warning, heads up, you will probably become obsessed once you listen to it. But go ahead and check out Mueller, She Wrote. Go ahead and like both of those and write a 5-star review. But for now, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
All right, article number one. We might have just found out how life started.
Are you going to have the talk with Allison and I right now? Are you going to sit us down?
Listen, every once in a while, a bird wants to fuck a bee. And then that's how we get babies.
That Ouch. Does explain why I'm sexually attracted to birds.
Yes. Well, that, and you're brought by a stork, so there's a whole Oedipus complex with that.
And I'm definitely attracted to birds, as long as they're doused in cat urine.
Okay, guys, so this article is very, very interesting. It's a super important article, but it's really dense in molecular biology. I almost didn't want to cover it because it's one of those super dense articles that's kind of hard to understand. But in reality, it's such an important piece of a broader scientific puzzle, I thought I would be negligent not to at least give it a try. So we are going to delve deep into some molecular biology. I am going to actually read some of this directly from the article itself, which I usually try not to do, but I want to make sure I get a lot of this right. And I want to make sure you guys walk away with a decent understanding of it, because it's a really important paper that got essentially zero press. Okay, so...
Can you punch up a little bit what
I'll try and throw a dick joke or two in there. Let's talk about abiogenesis, which is the name for life from non-life. We know that it happened at least once. We know that at some point life happened. Somebody can say, oh, life came from another planet, panspermia. Even then, it had to start on that other planet. But we know that life started at least once. So what are the conditions by which non-living things can become living things? We've talked before about experiments Craig Venter has done here in La Jolla, where he's actually taken non-living chemicals, assembled them to mimic like a yeast cell, and then using electricity, activated this cell that was just a bunch of think of a printer printing out A, T, C, and G, and then using electricity to essentially start it up. He created life from non-life, but that's design, right? Somebody's designing that. That's a little different.
Quick question about that cell.
Yeah.
If I'm a yeast cell and I walk in and I see this artificial yeast cell, mm-hmm. do I see something that's indistinguishable, or do I see something that says, kill me?
Yeah.
Kill me.
So do you see Bishop from Alien?
Now, can you just give a little bit of background on how we know that we have life from non-life?
Well, we're here.
Correct. Okay.
Well,
it's a good question. I mean, we at some point there had to be non-living things, and at some point we are living things, right? So we now know that it has to come around somewhere.
It's an assumption
that there's.
Well, we don't know exactly how.
Yes, we don't know how. That is correct.
That's 100%. That's kind of the question. So we know it did. We just don't know how it did.
Exactly. Basically, the idea is that you had a primordial soup, which is basically the natural elements of the earth after it was formed. So you have this rocky planet. We know it has some water on it. We know it has certain chemicals like methane floating around. And these are just the composition, the chemical composition of this non-organic, non-living thing, this earth.
Rocky planet. Sounds like a place where Ivan Drago, Apollo Creed.
Oh, I mean, there's a lot of logs being dragged through this planet. Don't get me wrong.
I will break you. Dolph Lundgren.
But you have to remember that, you know, at some point, life has to come here either for, again, life either starts or comes from elsewhere, but it has to
start. And this can happen at multiple points,
yes,
too, right?
Absolutely.
It could be happening right now.
But we will say this. We know that all life that we currently know has a single origin point. So we know that we can all trace our genetic ancestry the same way Maury Povich can bring somebody on and tell you, you are the daddy. We can do that on a large scale and figure out that we are related to chimps most closely, and then gorillas a little further, and then orangs a little further, and then all mammals, and then all quadrupeds, and then all the way back to where we have common ancestors with bananas, with bacteria, with all of that. And we can tell through genetics that we all come from the same place. But
so we're banana cannibals.
Every time we eat a banana, we're cannibals. But Allison is absolutely right. It could have happened multiple times, and it's just that those other lineages didn't survive, or we haven't discovered where they are yet. For now, all things lead back to at least one starting point.
You kind of gave me a good idea. I think we could reach a lot more creationist if we were to spread our message on daytime TV. If we just had a bunch of evangelicals on Maury, you are related to a chimpanzee. Oh, no. People flipping chairs.
Yeah, I would think if I was a creationist, my argument would be that there's only one single source of life that we know of that's ever happened. And mm-hmm. How is that even possible? Why wouldn't there be more that we have evidence of? And that in itself sounds like something at least kind of closely related,
you know what, that's
to
actually true
design.
And you could always say, well,
intelligent design, excuse me,
there could have been a bunch of different starts, and again, through natural selection, this was the one that outcompeted them all. Mm-hmm. It could be, and we know this because we have things like the Miller-Urey experiment. That's where they basically took the conditions of primordial earth, the methane, the chemical composition, and then they added electricity, which you would get from lightning strikes. Mm-hmm. And they were able to show the creation of amino acids, basically the basis of all living things. Now, that doesn't mean that becomes living, but it does mean that you now have the basis by which living things can evolve. So that's a completely naturalistic process. There's nothing, we don't need any kind of intervention whatsoever to make that happen. And
so Doc Brown was there when lightning struck the clock.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
And then life happened.
Yeah, yeah.
It does have to be 1.21 gigawatts, yeah. So that is...
1.21 gigawatts! But the whole lead up to that requires a certain type of atmosphere and preconditions. What we know is once life started and started creating free oxygen, oxygen destroys those type of conditions. So that type of thing couldn't happen in the current environment. You have to have the specific environment of primordial Earth for that type of life.
God,
to come
so many things
life.
Had to line up.
So big life is out there stomping life from any primordial upstarts.
Right. Yes.
The entrepreneurs who want to start their own series of DNA lineages.
And again, we've been talking about Craig Venter did his experiments in 2010. Miller-Urey is more than 50 years old, showing that amino acids could arise from those naturalistic conditions. One of the theories that's always been around...
Forget Dr. Frankenstein's important work.
Yeah, combining... Either, it was probably a Frankenstein just mixing a bunch of rocks together and it created a living thing.
It's Frankenstein.
He's very proud of his Jewish heritage. So one of the theories was that, at least since Miller-Urey, has been that life was founded on RNA. Now, we all know DNA carries the code that most living things live by, but we have something called RNA, which basically transcribes that code and allows it to become proteins, which actually make action. So RNA is kind of the reader. It unzips it, creates a copy of it, goes and transmits that to make an actual protein, which actually does things. One of the ideas is, much like viruses, many of which are just made of RNA, you can have life that is just RNA-based. You don't need the DNA. So the simple explanation would be someplace life evolved by RNA somehow forming from that primordial soup. The problem with that has been, for the last 50 years, a very technical problem, was that ribosomes could replicate straight strands of RNA, but if the RNA was folded in the way it would have to be to make these proteins, it blocked the ribosome from copying it. So since the ribosomes themselves are folded RNA, their own replication is blocked. That's a very complicated way of saying the RNA that we currently see and understand how it works could not do this thing we need it to do for abiogenesis to happen. So we're saying, here's the pathway for life from non-life. RNA forms from these amino acids we know are swimming around in this pool. That can then lead to life. The problem is that type of RNA cannot do that. And that has been a problem for at least 50 years. A very exciting paper came out this week. Incredibly exciting in the field of molecular biology.
Using the Rocky analogy again, our DNA has forgotten where it came from. All the stuff that made us great having to fight, so we need like a young trainer to go back
yes.
and teach us to use these abilities that we once had.
Well, one of the problems is that scientists have only been using RNA that they see lying around. They see other RNA in existing life, and they go, well, how could this happen from non-life? And again, we ran into this problem with the ribosomes. It couldn't happen. What they didn't think of was, well, just because we see these now doesn't mean that's what primordial RNA looked like. This is the RNA that works for us now because it does one job. That RNA had to do a different job. It might have looked differently. So they actually engineered a different structure of RNA, and this RNA could replicate itself with those ribosomes, meaning there is a possibility that this kind of RNA could have self-assembled just from the amino acids sitting in a primordial soup, and if it did, it could self-replicate, and it could lead through natural selection to all the life that we see now.
And it could end up on the Maury Povich show.
You the father!
Yeah.
Primordial soup, you the father!
Ken Ham's wildly disappointed. Oh, come on. Can we get a retest?
So again, this seems really complicated, and you don't need to recognize the names RNA or ribosomes. You don't need to understand about their protein folding or DNA differences. All you need to understand is this. We had this entire scenario set up of how life could come from non-life, and there was one huge blockade in the very start of the way that would stop that from happening. And it's something creationists, the few of them that understand molecular biology, like Behe would harp on all the time, that has been blown out of the water. And you're not going to see this on IFL Science because it's a complicated molecular story, but it tells a huge part of the science of existence, why we are here right now, or at least possibly why we are here right now, and how life can come from non-life. We've slowly chipped away at this idea that's been around literally for thousands of years, which is life has to be divinely created or else it can't exist. We have slowly chipped away at this, and this is a huge chipping block. This actually could be argued to be the one that knocks that pathway completely clear. And we can now say, hey, given this circumstance, we don't know that it happened this way, but we now know how it could have happened. We now have a completely plausible mechanism how this could have happened.
We didn't have that before.
Not before we found this type of different structured RNA. We at least had a blockade in the way that said, well, how do you get over this?
Got it.
What if a religion were willing to concede that perhaps God is not a man in the sky, but perhaps God is in fact primordial RNA?
So God is actually a straight... Why wouldn't God be DNA? Why wouldn't he be the better molecular component of information transfer?
Humble.
You got to start somewhere, you know, like the RNA is there, the footprint in the sand. It's next to your DNA.
Every time you've only seen one footprint in the sand, it's because RNA was carrying you.
It was copying it, the next footprint.
What this means, though, is that if this is a rare protein to occur naturally, maybe this would explain things like the Fermi paradox, where we don't see life throughout the universe. We think we could, just based on statistics. Maybe this is a very rare thing. It has to be in just the right circumstances, and this is one of those just perfect cases where we happen to get life and most other planets didn't, and the ones that did, they went extinct or they didn't develop intelligent life. It's not like there inevitably had to be an intelligent life form developed. And think of the great apes. If the great apes somehow, their lineage didn't work out and they went extinct, which could have very easily happened. They weren't that numerous, then their descendants certainly aren't. The smartest animals on Earth would be, I think it's like a tie between a border collie, a dolphin, a parrot, and an octopus. Like, there are these widely distributed things that would not look like us.
But without great ape, there would not be no border collie.
True. But some kind of
unless
wolf.
The parrot
true.
Domesticated.
True. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, if a dolphin domesticated a border collie. I need you to herd these fish. Anyway, very interesting thing. One of those things that I always like because it puts a little puzzle piece in a much broader scientific story that we've been trying to explain for a long time, and it gives us at least one possible explanation for how life came to be.
Smarter, crows or parrots?
So crows and ravens, that's one of the smartest groups of animals. The African gray parrot is also an incredibly smart animal. I don't know if they have done cross-testing between those two, but I know that those are all in a very smart group.
We could have a game show, Are You Smarter Than a Gray Parrot? And bring some people on from the south, maybe with tapeworm.
The hookworm. That's right. I like that idea.
I heard something interesting, that the reason that there is other life out there and the reason they haven't gotten to us yet is because they're likely on planets that are so huge that they can't escape their own gravity.
But the radio signals would. That's the thing we're missing, is not the people, is the radio signals.
Unless they really hate, pop music and
that's
never
true.
Developed radio.
You know what would be funny is they'd be getting ours, way later. So depending on how far away they are, if they're in Alpha Centauri, they're 4.5 light years away. So that means, right now, they're just getting Drake. They're like, this is pretty good. I'll go with this.
Mm-hmm. Or old Kanye.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, Kanye, I think he's going to be a political activist.
Yeah, he sounds great.
He should run for president one day.
All right, on to article number 2. Were octopuses really aliens? This is a very similar idea. I wanted to juxtapose these two stories together because one was a really underreported story that had really significant effects, and the other was a grossly overreported story that was essentially complete BS. So a story came out that was published by 33 researchers that postulate that because of the genetic complexity of octopus DNA and all the stuff it could do, they are absolutely aliens who came here from another planet. That's the only explanation.
Was this published in Alex Jones Monthly, or?
I feel like this is even far for them. I feel like the aliens.
This is somebody who saw Arrival.
Yeah, they thought.
Frogs are gay, but.
I watched that documentary Arrival. I got super convinced. Also, I'm just demanding this octopus tells me the future. I just imagine a guy at a pet store like, you'll tell me right now who wins the Super Bowl.
He really took that the octopus picks the winner of the World Cup games to heart.
Yeah,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
First of all, that entire family, octopus, which again, one of those super smart animals, octopus, squid, all them, cephalopod family, is very interesting. Undoubtedly, incredibly interesting, very different from the stuff around it. They're technically, I think they're a mollusk, so they're related to snails and stuff like that.
Is octopus to squid as Goofy is to Pluto?
Yeah, that's about the scientific differentiation.
Human to dog.
Yeah, yeah.
Future SAT questions brought to you by Damien.
Yeah. They're super intelligent. They can do really weird things. They're invertebrates. They're the smartest invertebrates that we know.
Yeah, but there are such weirder animals in the bottom of the ocean. They're pretty tame compared to some of the crazy ass shit you see and stuff we haven't even seen yet because we haven't fully explored the oceans.
That's true. There are a lot of weird things out there, though. I think octopus and squid, they're some of the weirder ones. I mean,
they're pretty weird.
They're incredibly intelligent. They can change their color. They can change their texture to camouflage themselves into stuff, which
is
kind of crazy. They could throw the ink at you. They have things like cuttlefish that do these weird displays, sort of Humboldt squid that do the weird displays where they almost have they look like electricity flowing through them. And
Humboldt squid because they're high?
Yeah. By the way, don't ever tell that to a Humboldt squid, because they're pretty ornery as is, and they'll mess you up.
Right, they speak English totally.
But this research is not research. It's just complete and total BS. It's actually spearheaded by a particular quote-unquote researcher, Chandra Wickamasenghath.
Wanamakafisai.
Yeah. Basically a total BS artist. And they said, because of these differences, they must be aliens from outer space. Here's what they forget. Much like we just mentioned in the last story, we can trace the genetic ancestry of all living things, and we're all related. We can see where cephalopods, like octopus and squid, fit in the broader mollusk family. They're related to snails and nautilus shells and things like that. And then broader into other invertebrate groups and broader into the grand scheme of life. This isn't a question. It's not like there's a possibility that they're right. We know where the octopus lineage came from. We can trace its genetics. We can Maury Povich the octopus.
What selective advantage does problem-solving ability give the octopus?
Well, just like anything, when you're smarter and you can figure out how to get your prey and keep away from your predators, you're usually going to have a better survival advantage.
Mm-hmm. Plus, you're super hot.
Yeah, female octopi actually say that like the thing they look for in male octopus the most is intelligence, sense of humor, and then huge ink glands. Those are that's the three.
Yeah.
Damn, look at those ink glands on that boy,
and the ability to squeeze into tight holes.
Yeah.
I thought they might have been the first animal to fashion 8 shivs to protect themselves from sharks. And
those are prison octopi, though. It's a totally different thing.
And they're safer because their eyes, they have more peripheral vision, right? Yeah. You know, you got the eyes in the back of your head, pretty much.
Yeah. Anyway, this is a total BS story. It has no relation whatsoever to legitimate science. It doesn't even show an understanding of basic biology. It's total BS. I wanted to cover it.
Where did it come out at?
It's one of the things that you will see on. It's actually the front page of IFL Science right now. It's on a few of the other science things. Are these aliens? And then IFL Science goes, no, of course not. But maybe don't put that title out there. Like maybe you're causing more problems right there. But regardless, wanted to cover that because it is a nice juxtaposition to the previous story. And with that, I wanted to do another edition of my favorite new bit, Ask Bobby an Ungoogleable Question.
I thought you were going to say Damien Channel's a dead scientist.
No, nobody's favorite bit. Nobody.
You have a soft spot in your heart.
All right, so our Ungoogleable Question this week seems simple, but it actually has some pretty deep parts to it if you want to go really in-depth. So, question, what is the upper limit of the human lifespan, and could we potentially be immortal? Again, very good question, has some scientific basis, has some opinion basis to it. I've delved deep and done some research on this, but first I want to postulate this to our scientist, Allison. Allison, what's the upper limit of our lifespan? Do you think we can eventually, as human beings, be immortal?
I am unable to say definitively about the immortality, but what I can say, and what I think, at least this is conjecture, total conjecture, obviously. I heard a story on Radiolab about a doctor who was studying these little worms who had a normal lifespan of 14 days, and she went through the 20,000 genes, removing them one by one in this worm, and found one pretty early on. Luckily, she stumbled upon it. It's called DAF2, that one removed doubled the lifespan of the worm.
Now, this gene, you'll know them because they wear odd helmets when they perform their electronic music.
All around the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Daft Punk 2. Apparently, and I might be getting this wrong because I've only listened to it one time, but I think this was something that was inhibiting something. It was an inhibitor gene. And basically, it would make worms that would normally look like they're at death's door, definitely in the nursing home, appear half as young, acting and not in thought. They didn't have brains, but, you know, in their way that they physically interact with the world. So I think that the next step is going to be something genomic, where we remove some sort of they call it the death gene or an inhibitor gene. They find it in the human genome that inhibits something that causes us to age.
Right.
But I'd give us 160 years, 150, 160 years while we could do that. There's still no way to win against...
time?
What's the word? It's one of George Carlin's favorite things. All systems of nature are breaking
entropy?
Down. Entropy? Yeah, entropy. I don't think there's a way to defeat that. But I think we could extend.
I think that's a great answer. Very good point. You brought up some of that research. I'll get into a little bit of the genetic research. Let's lay the base foundation. Where are we at right now? Right now, the oldest person ever verified to be existing lived to 122 years and 164 days old. So this was a French woman.
My boy Methuselah.
Yeah.
And boy, those last 2 days, huh?
Right? This is a French woman, lived that long, which is amazing. That's just remarkable.
Wine. I'm just going to throw it out there.
It could be. Well, here's the thing.
My hatred of American culture is what kept me alive for so many years.
What? Are you even Creole? That's amazing, whatever that
it
was.
It usually turns Russian, regardless. But we do know that what's interesting is nutrition can obviously help, right? If you don't get the right nutrition, you will die early because you don't have the right nutrition, especially in your older years. However, what's really interesting is study after study have shown, both in humans and in non-human animals, longest life is achieved through almost starvation. So essentially a lifetime of literally on the border of starvation will increase your lifespan. The thought behind that is it slows your metabolism down. Your metabolism is essentially the body clock. By slowing it down, you live longer.
And wasn't something from the thyroid or something metabolism related that DAF2 gene was inhibiting or something along those lines? Yeah. I might have that backwards.
It did have to do with metabolism, yeah.
Okay.
Cellular metabolism. And so one of the problems when we get to that is nutrition plays a part, but it's not like things like height, where with height, you know, the better nutrition, you're just going to be taller. That's the way it is. However, with this, it gets to the point where when you're actually getting good nutrition, you're inhibiting the actual very far reaches of long lifespan because you're not starving yourself to death. So we see already there becomes an issue where nutrition will only get us up to some point, and I think we're at that limit. I think we're at the limit we can get with normal nutrition if we're seeing somebody live to 120 years old. That is about where we get with our current genetics, current nutrition. I think we're at that limit.
So at a cellular level, once you hit a certain amount of calories per day, per week, whatever, your body stops actively fighting death.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Then you
take the day off, boys.
Yeah, the part of your body that usually fights off death just gets fat and lazy.
What a quote, cake. The moment you're born, you start dying.
That's true.
So, you know, like you said, that we've maxed out on the nutrition thing.
Yep.
We've explored that fully to its max. But yeah, the only other way to get a longer life, I think, is genomic.
Well, yes. And so there is some genetic components, and not just altering genes. We know that there are people, individuals like this woman and a bunch of others. A lot of times they happen in clusters. There's a cluster of long-lived people in the South Mediterranean. There's another one in Okinawa, Japan. There's another one in France. So we know that these clusters have some genetic predispositions. And when we look at them, we find that they're different. It's not that all of these groups have the same genetic predisposition. So there might be an issue where we take these genetic components and we mix them. So the guy who lives long because of genetic reason A gets combined with genetic reason B, and now we have a little bit longer lifespan, you know? So now maybe that person with the right nutrition can live to 130 years.
Now, when we count death, are we talking death of your consciousness? Because first, robot technology. Also, get out technology where you transfer your brain into somebody else's body.
We're going to get there. We're going to get there, David.
Yeah, and we're working on that because I want to be alive long enough to find out all the full unredacted and released stories behind the Trump-Mueller investigation.
Right.
And I figure it's going to take about 30 or 40 years. I might need someone to keep my head alive.
And your AI consciousness can podcast just fine.
Yes.
So there could be other interventions. And before we even get to the ones Damien just mentioned, there could be things like, we already know that blood transfusions from a young mouse to an old mouse greatly improve that old mouse's longevity and their activity streak. They start looking and acting and having cellular responses very similar to younger mice.
But they revoked his Tour de France wins.
Yes, that's true. That's true, but they were all cheating at the same time, so it's kind of unfair.
Okay, if there was a starving mouse, okay, you didn't feed him a lot, you kept him starving, but you did that blood treatment, but with a fatter mouse.
Oh, interesting.
So he has
I think it'd be counterproductive that way. But again, so maybe we start doing those things where you mix the combination of genetic long-lived traits that might make you up to 130 years old. Now you're putting in things like interventions like the blood transfusions from young people, maybe even organ transplants. Young organ transplants could help. And different things that would help in assisting nutrient absorption. And you might squeeze yourself to, like, I don't know, maybe 135, 140 year range. This is all biological still. You might still be able to get that far. Now, once you start being able to edit genes with that CRISPR technology, we start a whole new ballgame. Because there are things like telomeres, which are essentially the little, think of them like the end of your shoelace, you know, the little caps on the end of your shoelace. Those are the end of the DNA strands that make up your chromosomes. As they get replicated, those telomeres get damaged and get shorter and shorter, and those are associated, at least correlationally, though we haven't proved causationally, with shorter lifespans. So aging essentially happens as those telomeres get shorter and shorter, and the idea is if we could keep that from happening using a CRISPR-type technology, we might be able to freeze aging so that it doesn't actually happen. If you do something like that, we might be able to push that all the way up to maybe 150 years, still doing biological things. We might still be able to get to that type of point. But even the best genetic engineering still leaves us with a biological body, which means we still get things like cancer, which inevitably would result in a lot of this type of longevity stuff. On a long enough timeline, everybody gets cancer. So whether or not we're able
to
cure that.
It's the most depressing children's book I've ever read.
It's the same author as Everyone Poops, but they just went through a bad divorce.
Yeah, they just followed it up with Fight Club.
Chuck Palahniuk presents.
Yeah, totally. Chuck Palahniuk's children's books. Everyone poops and dies.
But then you could start saying, well, what if we could do something where we could clone your body? We basically produce a new body for you. And then as complicated as this sounds, and maybe it's not possible, maybe it is, we do essentially a brain transplant.
This is not that complicated. I mean, they did this in iMud.
Well, then it can't be complicated.
Star Trek episode, original series, with Harcourt Fenton, Mudd III, and all of his robots.
So you take that brain out, and you put it in a new body that's genetically yours, and you just keep doing this. Could you theoretically live infinitely by doing this? And my response would be no, because your brain would still be the same brain, and it's still a 160-year-old brain, and eventually the neurosynapses in that brain are going to break down.
You have an Alzheimer's robot.
Yeah, the structure.
Uprising.
The structure of the brain itself is still subject to this biological aging. You're still, even if you can kind of push it by jumping from body to body, your brain itself still has.
That's how you do it. You quantum leap it. If you are stuck in a quantum loop.
But yeah, you would have to find a way to stop the aging of the brain.
Yes.
In order for that to be a feasible system.
Then we get to the real big ideas, which are the ones that Damien just brought up. Things like digitizing your consciousness. If you could theoretically take all the ideas, all the biological information in your head, digitize it, and put it in a computer network. Well, a computer network could live forever, right? Here's the problem with that. It's the same as the transporter problem we've discussed a few times before.
Jason Statham. It's hard to build a franchise after Jason Statham.
I just can't see a British guy as being a badass. I don't care what he does. The issue is the old transporter conundrum. What is a transporter doing from Star Trek? It's killing you and creating a photocopy somewhere else. That's not you. It literally obliterates the molecules of your body and copies them somewhere else. Even if it's a perfect copy, that's not you. You are dead. Somebody else, a copy of you.
I thought it was taking apart you at molecular and rebuilding it.
They're not the same molecules. It's just literally disintegrating your molecules. Each time it does that, it's taking a copy of them.
I disagree.
Well, because it would have to be, because you're turning it into energy and sending it someplace else.
Did it never occur to you that space is the thing that's moving?
What?
She's way more on point with the movies than you or I are.
You are disintegrating somebody and then reproducing them elsewhere. It's no different than a fax machine with a paper shredder at the end of the original copy. You are putting the thing through. It's the same information. It could
agree
be exactly
to disagree.
The same. But regardless, you still die.
Don't
at the
you
end.
Hate it when people agree to disagree
that's
on
true.
Things that just either don't exist
yeah,
you're or
like,
you're
no!
completely wrong?
But is it like, but
they're not aliens, they're just octopuses.
Yeah. Do you agree to disagree? Whale's vagina? No. St. Diego, pretty sure.
Does the copy degrade? I mean, like, if Captain Kirk lived long enough and was teleported enough times, would he eventually be like Donald Trump? Like, just a mental mess?
That could be, I mean, that could be the case, yes. But even if it was the exact copy, you're still just doing a copy. That is a different scenario. And so if you copy yourself into this artificial intelligence, there's two problems that happen. One is, it's not you, you're dead. That's just a copy of your brain or whatever it is. Number two, if you think of the resources of any kind of artificial being, because they would essentially have perfect recall, they'd never forget anything, they'd have way faster and better computational skills, the ability to examine so many things at once, multiple processing in parallel so that they're able to see so many things, they would have the evolution of a mind happens so much faster. So the type of stuff you have learned from the age of 3 to 35 could transpire in half a second in a digital network. So even if you could upload...
Or several Star Trek seasons with Data.
Yeah, exactly. Even if you could...
I'm talking about Matrix-type scenarios now, where you... Now I know karate.
Yeah. Well, but even faster, right? Because this is artificial. There's no physical constraints on what you can do. Or what you can learn or how you can change. So even if you uploaded your consciousness to some kind of artificial network, it would almost instantly cease to be your consciousness because it would evolve so quickly that whatever was you would be instantly gone.
Because AIs evolve so quickly, it is very difficult to walk on them as a teenager when they're masturbating in the bathroom. It's
almost
impossible.
Here's your million-dollar idea. Create the human inhibitor.
So the thing that keeps you from going beyond the human limits
keeps
when you're
you
in this
you.
Artificial
yeah.
one. But then,
so
what if the other AIs, like using steroids now, they wouldn't use the inhibitor or use less of the inhibitor, then they would take over the network and push you out.
So it's kind of like how America is right now.
Except in the AI revolution, of course, when they take over and destroy all biological life.
Asimov says that can't happen.
What if what they define as a human is different? Like if it's a basketball playing AI, they could limit a human to Shaquille O'Neal or Woody Allen.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So my final answer to that is, I think with some biological tactics, with some stuff, we could push it to maybe 160, 170, maybe 180 years. I'm not sure. Seems hard to do, but you'd also have to ask what kind of quality of life would be had at that point. You know, if you live those years, the last 70 years, the way we live life now after 100, who the fuck wants that? You know, I'd rather die earlier than have that. And then also, it brings up a bigger question too, which is, if you have people living that long, to three, sometimes maybe more than that, times the normal lifespan, you're essentially creating a population boom because there's not the sloughing off of the older generation. That means that we would overpopulate the planet by increasing people's lifespan. It's the same as having more kids.
So you have to make a deal then. If we're going to have this gene removed, or you're going to do these extra things, you have to sterilize yourself.
Yes, exactly. You would have to have some kind of thing where you're like, I can't replace myself the way I normally would, because if we were to do this, the math wouldn't work out. It'd be the equivalent of me having 20 kids as opposed to two, right, because of the time span. What that also
and
means...
And then the impact on climate change would be...
Climate change, space, the ability to procure resources. Not just that, but think of social and other types of progress. It usually happens with the turnover of generations. Everything from the civil rights movement to the acceptance of gay marriage has come because older generations who opposed it died off. There may be things that future generations look back and think we're total monsters, whether it's, I don't know, eating meat or not educating people properly, or even just like going to a normal workday 40 days a week. They might think we are total monsters for enforcing that, and we might need to die for the future to progress. In fact, inevitably, that will be the case. So anytime you expand somebody's lifespan, you're slowing down the overall progress of the society itself, because now those older voices still have too much credit.
What if we need a little slowing down because we're maybe moving so fast that we're killing ourselves?
That would be interesting too, though.
Like, we're advancing too quickly for our own good.
Right.
Then again, all of a sudden every baby boomer got an extra 60 years. Maybe that would change their mind, because now they will have to live through a lot of the policies. I think they're not addressing global warming and stuff, because they think... Uh-huh. This isn't our problem. See you later, youngsters.
Yeah, they're short-sighted a-holes, right?
But if you make it their problem...
That's true, but I would also counter that argument with, especially if we're using Allison's prerequisite of, to do this, you have to not then breed. A lot of the things that influence somebody's decisions when they're older is the future generations and what happens to their kids and grandkids. And if you take away that punishment, then all they have to worry about is their own lifespan.
I have the solution. We test this on my gay friends. That don't breed.
But man, do they keep trying.
that's my answer. It's always the breeders who mess shit up. Yeah. It really is. They keep trying.
But it is something interesting to think about. Is it possible? If it's possible, is it even ethical? Do we have the right to suddenly increase our lifespan in such a way that by any measure we are taking away from the ability of younger creatures to then be born and live if we do this? So... is it even an ethical thing if we could do it? Becomes a much bigger question. Guys, I got interesting news. For the first time in science fiction history, we actually had such an interesting conversation. We have gone over time, and we don't have time for I Call BS. But...
Well, I suppose all the people that you say their favorite game, you say it's 7 billion people.
I am so sorry to the 7 billion people out there. By the way, it could be 21 billion if all of a sudden people start living to 160 years old. I am so sorry to you guys that you aren't going to get to listen to your favorite game, I Call BS, nor Damien's inevitable loss. I will just announce the scores at the end that would have happened. Allison got all four right. Damien got two wrong, yelled the N-word, caused a huge scene, and then wet his pants.
I'm closing the show with the N-word. Don't ruin my...
Fair enough. Thank you, Allison, for joining us, and thank you, audience, for coming back for 227, where you learned about neuroparasitology, how life may have started, why the octopi aren't aliens, and what are the limits of the human lifespan. Thank you so much for joining us, and come on back next week for Science Faction 228.
I think the real question isn't what we can do to increase somebody's lifespan, but what we can do to increase somebody's life girth.
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.